Welcome to the Centre for Public Integrity's podcast series. The Centre is Australia's leading democracy research institute. In these podcasts, we aim to bring listeners with us as we explore with key decision makers and policy designers just how our democracy works. I'm Michael Barker, a member of the Centre board and a former federal court judge. And today, I'm very pleased to welcome to the podcast Sophie Scomps. Welcome, Sophie.
Thank you for having me.
It's really lovely to meet you. I'm never sure as I do these podcasts whether the esteemed person who's sitting in our federal parliament, as a number of my recent interviewees have been, are really politicians or veteran, brilliant athletes. I discovered that you were a sprinter and a middle distance runner. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. I spent a lot of my early life running around a track, and I'm very pleased to say that my son has found that passion now. I've got one of my sons is a 1500 meter runner. He loves it too, but I do think there's something in that competitive athlete side of things. But also, you know, you if you're an athlete, you learn that you're capable of so much more than what you maybe imagine for yourself. And when you push yourself and when you put the time in, the results come. So it's a really good life lesson, I think, for people to be involved in sport.
One of the complaints historically during my lifetime about the major parties, and we'll get back to them, is that there were sort of too many lawyers in all sides, too many trade unionists on another side, too many big business operators on another side. And it does make you ask, how important do you think people's backgrounds are to their parliamentary careers? Have you reflected on that?
I have reflected on that, and actually I do think I was a GP, a general practitioner, prior to getting this role, and before that an emergency doctor. But I think it's really important for there to be a diverse range of people who've had different life experiences in Parliament. And I also think that actually having been a GP, it was a really good lead into this role as an MP, because you see your role as one of service, and actually when you're a GP, you realise how important listening is. And they say that listening is 90% of the diagnosis, taking a good history and listening, and you're going to get it wrong unless you do some really deep listening. And so I think bringing those types of skills into my role as an MP has been really, really important. But also, we were at a point before the last election where people were just feeling cut out and shut out of their democracy, ignored, taken for granted, you name it. And so that ability and that willingness to listen has been absolutely fundamental, I think, to all of us who are community independents.
The process by which you got elected as a community candidate and then elected to the parliament as a community candidate, is there something about that process that in a sense could be patented? Could even the major parties learn from it? Is there something about it which is good for democracy?
100%. I think a lot of people make the comment, because I was a bit reluctant. I think a number of us were somewhat reluctant initially just because we didn't have that experience maybe in politics before. But in actual fact, what a lot of people say is those people that are reluctant are probably the best people for the job. You know, it's not about yourself. It's not about your career. It's not about some power trip that you're going on. It really, you need to do it for the right reasons. And I do think it is a fantastic process where you start with listening to the community. We started sort of a couple of years before the election. And really what we were aiming to do initially was just purely listen to our electorate and find out what was truly important to people who lived here in Mackellar. And the aim initially was to give a report to the various candidates of the parties in the lead up to the election. But one of the questions we were asking people, we asked, what are the issues that are important to you and what solutions you would like to see? One of the solutions was, well, we're being ignored. What we would like to see is we would like to have an independent like they have next door in Warringah. Where are they? We want to support them. And of course, we didn't have one. And so that's where this whole grassroots movement came from people deciding that is what they wanted, and it was very invigorating.
Well, you're the MP for McKellar, and I think you're pretty much next door to Warringah, aren't you?
That's exactly right. We were looking over the fence saying we want a bit of that action.
No.
And we'd seen as well how effective Zali had been that term from 2019 to 22. She had been a very powerful voice on action for on climate and the environment and integrity, all those things. And it was really inspiring, actually.
Take something like the climate topic. And it's my understanding that all of you who've been tagged teals had similar outlooks on improving Australia's performance, getting to net zero by 2050. Recently, the Parliament failed. They didn't give the opportunity to vote on the nature positive legislation. The Prime Minister shelved it. It seems to have been a rearguard action out of Western Australia, actually, which was disappointing for many people who were supporting that in the West. What can an independent or a group of independents do about a reluctant government on something like climate legislation?
Well, I think I always say it's as much what you do inside Parliament House as what you're doing outside Parliament House. And of course, it's all about leading the national conversation as well and having different voices speaking out in the national conversation. And we saw how absolutely powerful Helen Haynes was speaking out on the fact that we didn't have a national anti-corruption commission. And that became a really huge issue at the last election. And we also saw Zali Stegall speaking out really strongly about stronger action on climate change. And both those issues became key issues at the last election. So what can we do? We can keep speaking up. We can keep holding the government to account. We can keep calling it out. We can keep pushing. We can keep having conversations. And there is a lot of negotiations that go on. But I think one of the really strong things that we need to do is we need to keep building the integrity infrastructure of our democracy and our political system so that we do have far greater transparency around what the lobbying interests are, who's lobbying government, who's lobbying the opposition. Currently, it's very opaque, and we know that it's the lobbying industry is very powerful. So we need to open that up, make it far more transparent, and keep just shining a spotlight on issues like that.
That's a topic, amongst many others, that the Centre for Public Integrity is committed to exploring and advocating about. One thing I'm interested in, you arrive in Canberra, you're in the federal parliament. You've been there for nearly a full term. The elections will be coming up soon. Everyone says the 12th of April. How do you go in marshalling information? I mean, you need intellectual capability to take in a lot of information. You need good people to be able to give you briefing papers. You have to discuss things with people. How do you do it? Have you got enough resources?
No, we don't have enough resources. And you are aware, and I'm sure people are aware, that very early on in the piece, I think the Prime Minister's first decision was to cut our parliamentary staff from four people to one person. So that means that I have one advisor. And that means getting across all government legislation. It also means working. I've got one person to work with me on all the types of legislation and private members bill that I want to pursue and all the different amendments that I want to pursue. So we are working 7 days a week, really. But we are also very lucky that we are able to partner with organisations and institutes such as the Centre for Public Integrity, who have a deep amount of expertise, knowledge and research on specific issues. And so that's how we get across a lot of the different information that we need to get across, is that working with various organisations and institutions who have that deep research. And so that is very helpful.
Sophie, again, when you first arrived, I'm interested to know, not just, I suppose, when you first arrived, but as you've gone along, the reception you've got from the members of the established parties and other crossbenchers who weren't necessarily part of the Teals group, has it been conducive to democracy, one might ask?
I think it has. I think the others on the crossbench are fabulous. You've got people like Helen Hayes, who, you know, are community independents like Helen Haynes. You've got Diane Lee and you've got Andrew Wilkie, Rebecca Sharkey. They've been there. They've been very helpful with, you know, how things work in Parliament. But they're wonderful people. And also I should say that the relationships you have with people from all sides. You know, people are normal people. What you usually find is they're good people. You may or may not agree with what they say or do in Parliament, but, you know, typically they're good people and you can, you know, get on in a different way. But it is about having robust discussions, and we do meet regularly with ministers from the government and ministers as well from the coalition. So in keeping that dialogue open, I think, is really, really constructive.
Sophie, one of the complaints, it's probably an impression that I convey rather than any hard data that I have in my pocket or on my iPad as I talk to you, but it's a perception that politicians are in it for themselves, or at least they're looking after their mates. They're going to make sure they don't lose votes, let alone buy votes, at the next election. And that if there's big pots of money that have to be allocated to encourage good industry or regional activity or some new building to be built somewhere in the country or in their electorate, that's what they're on about. Pork barreling, for want of a better name. But you introduced a bill on this topic.
So I introduced a bill. So there's a couple of things there. I introduced a bill on the ending jobs for mates, because we had seen that prior to the last election, that had grown to a level that was really quite stark. And the example is the Administrative Appeals Tribunal that was so heavily sticked with political cronies that actually it had impaired the competence of that really important democratic institution. You had people who were being appointed who didn't have the right competency, skill or expertise to actually carry out those roles, and was done for political reasons in many instances. So in the end, the government decided that the best action, the best way forward, was to abolish that body. I, in the meantime, introduced a bill called Ending Jobs for Mates. It wasn't accepted. The government didn't accept it, but every time a new body was being established by the government, I would introduce an amendment that said, we need to have independent selection panels. This is the best way to ensure that we are, making impartial decisions and that we can build trust in these really important democratic institutions. I kept getting knocked back until we came to the re-establishment of the Administrative Review Tribunal. And I think that we managed to get adopted into legislation and mandated the use of independent selection panels for all the appointments to the new Administrative Review Tribunal. And I think that sets an incredible precedent for the way forward. Nothing like that had been taken on board before, and it really does set a precedent. And that's something that I'm extremely proud of.
We're very pleased to hear it. I established the State Administrative Tribunal in Western Australia and was an absolute given. You cannot run a body like that if it turns into a political appointment process. Everyone loses trust in the organisation.
So, yeah, and I think, yes, before the last election, I think trust was at an all-time low, and that was really symptomatic of the system being played somewhat politicised. And so it is important we try and keep our democratic institutions as strong as possible, and that's one way we can do it.
Sophie, I'm always interested because it's one of these things that's a little bit out of sight. I think the parliamentary committee processes, are you involved in those?
I get seconded into the health committee, which has been fantastic actually, because they only allow one independent on those committees. And it's sort of a little bit arbitrarily allocated. So I really wanted to be on the health committee because of my background and things, you know, I thought I could contribute a lot because I've got a master's in public health as well as be a GP and an emergency doctor in the past. And so actually Mike Freelander, the Labor chair of the committee, invited me onto that committee. So I was really pleased. But at the same time, they have to then bring in another Labor Party person. But with that committee, usually with any committee, usually there's a majority of government positions. So they get to determine the outcome or the reports that stem from the inquiries that are held. So that can be problematic. For our health committee, it was pretty universal where we did an inquiry into diabetes in Australia. And there was strong consensus around most of the recommendations, which was really good to see.
The question of the composition of a parliamentary committee of any sort is something that has interested the Centre for Public Integrity from time to time. On the one hand, I suppose it's a fact of life. No government's going to give away control over an important policy area. On the other hand, it just means you get predictable policy recommendations. Or is that a bit of a naive view of things?
No, I don't think it is. I think there are instances where the evidence is so compelling that there may be bipartisanship on the outcome. So we saw that with the gambling inquiry, and there was all parties, you know, independent, coalition, Labor, Green, there was a consensus about the way forward on that. And that's why it's been really disappointing to see that those banning gambling advertising on TV and radio and online has not gone ahead, because that was an instance where you had this multi-partisanship, this agreement, which is probably a little unusual, but in this case, everybody agreed that it was so hard. The gambling advertising was extremely harmful, and yet we haven't seen the legislation go through yet. It's been also stalled, held up.
I suppose a lot of people sort of know the answer why, and it's probably deeply political, but why hasn't a government acted on that sort of strong committee bipartisan view?
Exactly. That's where we see the lobbying come in. So there was a very clear recommendation that gambling advertising should be stopped online and on TV and on radio. It was a very clear recommendation with agreement from all sides. But then the lobbying starts. And so there was very strong lobbying both from the gambling industry, but also broadcasters. And so, and we saw that legislation was not brought in for a vote in the end, which was deeply, deeply disappointing. And it's something we need to keep working on. So that's where the lobbying power, the power of the corporations comes in to really influence political decision making. So in the end, you think, well, it's not down to the politicians based on the best evidence. It's down to corporate influence.
We'll get to political donations in a minute, but just staying with lobbying, it's going to become a bigger issue in the next period of time. But do you get lobbied by those same gambling interests? Are they wanting to talk to the Prime Minister or the relevant responsible minister and you, Teals, at the same time?
Yes. So everyone. So that's the thing. When you talk about lobbyists, you automatically sort of, a lot of people might have a negative sort of thought about lobbyists, but actually there's good and there's, you know, not so good. But we need to hear from people. Like, it's really important that we're hearing from a whole range of people. We need to hear from experts. We need to hear from peak bodies. And I like to hear as well from corporations, because you don't want to be making uninformed decisions. So I do like to hear from a cross range of, different perspectives. And I think that's really important. Where I have a problem, many of us have the problem, is when there's not transparency around who you're meeting with and why decisions are made. That's the big problem. And we have a system of lobbying currently where many of the lobbyists, because they're in-house lobbyists, are not registered. And so it's totally opaque who ministers and others are meeting with.
The courts, which I'm most familiar with, have a daily list. You can walk into the court building and you can see everything that's happening. You can go into the Administrative Review Tribunal and you'll see every body who's involved in it all. It ought to be possible to create a system that's not unlike that.
Oh, 100%. That's a given. It could be so easily implemented, and yet it's not. It's sort of been protected for so long. The status quo has been protected, but there needs to be far greater transparency around who's lobbying who and why and on what issues. Like you said, it could be easily implemented. And then just with that greater transparency, you can see where influences are coming in and why decisions are made.
Which sort of seamlessly takes us onto political donations, political finance, something which has interested me for a long time. Saying to Kate Cheney when I spoke to her, 1991, 92, I was one of the council assisting the WA Inc. Royal Commission and became intimately acquainted with Australian law at that time. Western Australia's improved its game. We've got an election here tomorrow, and you can look at the ABC website and see who's been giving money. There's a bit of a time lag, but it's not too bad.
Mm.
And I suppose if you're wanting to run a tutorial for politics students at a university or even at a high school, you could probably take the political donations law that went through Parliament recently to explain how the system works, and there'd be some unhappy campers, probably you amongst them.
Then that helped you.
What happened with that? Is it sort of an object lesson in how things can not go right?
Yes, I think so. I think that we all agree we need to take big money out of our politics. We need to get that individual influence of corporations and other individuals like the Clive Palmer effect who are trying to influence the outcome of elections. We need to really deal with that. But I think the way that the whole reform process was kind of overtaken, it was used instead as an opportunity to shut out competition. And that's where the problem comes in. To have a strong democracy, you need competition, you need lots of voices, and you need lots of eyes, lots of scrutiny, you need more people in there who are not aligned to one party or another, who are going to call things out, or who are going to call both the major parties out when they're not sort of acting the way that they've said that they're going to act. So that is what keeps our democracy strong. What the two major parties have done in this donation reform, electoral reform bill that they have got through is try and shut out competition from independents and minor parties. And the way they've done that is by leaving themselves the most monumentally massive loophole to be able to outspend independents and others multiple times over, which really makes a David and Goliath battle in the long run, or a very uneven playing field. I mean, there were some really good things in that reforms as well, like you were talking about having real-time disclosures or soon after, rather than waiting 12, 18 months for these donation disclosures to happen. I think that's a really good reform, bringing down the disclosure threshold so that now it's $5,000 instead of $16,000. It could have been lower. But the other real problem for me was that there's a lot of dark money still able to come in. So in the form of gifts or memberships or tickets to events. So there might be corporations that are paying $25,000 to be a member of a party business network or a particular event. That may not be defined as a donation, but it's still large sums of money. The other thing is it's not really keeping big money out of our democracy, because corporations, individuals can still donate up to $450,000 each year, and in addition, in an election year as well. So that's a lot of money. It's not really keeping big money out of politics.
Taking all of those things that have been happening during the last term, what do you sort of rate your biggest challenges over the term as you start to prepare for an election?
The biggest challenge of the term was, I think pretty clearly, was that we've been working 7 days a week, basically, for the 3 years. It's with that staff cut back, it's been relentless. It's been fantastic and stimulating, exciting and wonderful to work with all the people in Parliament, particularly the people on the crossbench. But it has been relentless, and I think it was it is not a healthy environment to have to work at that pace without stop for 3 years. And so I think that has been probably the biggest challenge, because there's multiple roles in this. There's not just the parliamentary, the legislative work, the amendments, the new bills, that, you know, looking at what the government's bringing in, make sure that you're consulting widely, both with experts plus with your community, what the impacts are going to be with peak bodies. There's a lot of work in every single piece of legislation that comes before Parliament. And we saw at the end of last year, there were 47 pieces of legislation that came in the 1 week, I think. So there's a lot of work to be done. At the same time, we want to be pushing agendas that are really important to the people in our electorate. So I have things that I know are important to the people here in McKellar, and I need to do a whole lot of work on those issues as well. So I think the biggest challenge was time and trying to really get across everything that we need to be doing. There's a lot to it. There's the legislation. There's the being a part of the community as well. You need to be out and about and hearing from and being a part of your community as well. So That's great fun. It's really good. That's the part I absolutely love. But it is quite relentless, I would say.
Well, at least you were a middle distance runner.
I think I need to be. Yes, exactly. You run hard and you run fast and you don't stop until you're all over the line.
There must have been what you'd classify as some wins during that period as well.
Yes, there have been. And that's the wonderful thing. I mean, there's wins that you don't hear about that are when you're negotiating with different ministers on different pieces of legislation and they amend things even before it's introduced into parliament. So that happens. They do listen. They do take advice. But the biggest win, I would say, was what I mentioned before, and that was getting into legislation, the fact that there needed to be independent selection panels for the appointments to the newly established Administrative Review Tribunal. And I think that that is incredibly important as it sets that precedent for future changes around those appointments laws. So that was a huge win. Another big win was the only change or the only strengthening of our environment laws came from an amendment that I put in that was also put in through the Senate as well. And that was around expanding what's known as the water trigger, or protecting, making sure that all forms of fracking for gas came in under that water trigger law. So if there was likely to be damage to our water resources, our rivers, our aquifers, then that could be called in to be looked at by the federal government. So that was it. That is the one and only law that was strengthened for our environment under our Environment Act. So that was a great win as well.
I was in Canberra for the Centre when the National Anti-Corruption Bill legislation was going through. I probably met you and all the others in a big room as we talked about what was happening. Are you happy with the way that's gone?
The Anti-Corruption Commission, I think it could have been set up so that it was more robust. I think a lot of us were disappointed that there weren't public hearings. Transparency is so important to that building of trust within our society so that they can trust the political and democratic institutions. The other thing that was really disappointing was the fact that we didn't strengthen our public sector whistleblower laws during this last term as well. A lot of us, again, were pushing for that greater whistleblower protections within the National Anti-Corruption Commission. When that didn't happen, we wanted to see them strengthened in the Public Interest Disclosure Act. That hasn't happened either. And now we see we've had David McBride, who's ended up in jail for his role in calling out the atrocities the war crimes in Afghanistan. And we now see as well Richard Boyle similarly about to face a similar fate potentially for calling out really egregious behaviours of the ATO, which were sustained under various inquiries. So our democracy does, and the National Anti-Corruption does, rely heavily on whistleblowers. And you can understand that whistleblowers would be very reluctant to come forward when that is how you are treated. We hear that they lose almost everything. They lose their careers, their families, may end up in jail. So why on earth would you be a whistleblower? And when our democracy depends so heavily on whistleblowers, then we're really letting our own democracy and our own people down by not protecting them better.
Sophie, we're getting close to the time where we'll finish the podcast, and I have a couple of related questions, I suppose. But the first one is, what unfinished business do you have from your time in this parliament?
I've got so much unfinished business, that's crazy. There's so much more to do, and we all know that. And there's things that are really important. We've got so much to do in terms of strengthening our democracy and embedding that integrity infrastructure into our political system. So as I just mentioned, greater protection for whistleblowers, making sure we have greater transparency and regulation around lobbyists, making sure we have truth in political advertising. Already this election, it's already been a bit dirty with misleading ads being pushed out by coal-funded entities. So there's all of these things that need to be doing. We need to end pork barreling as well, the misuse of public funds to try and influence elections, you know, different seats. All these things undermine our democracy. And I personally think that probably the most important thing we can do is make sure that we have a robust democracy that people trust. We see what's happening in America, and that's one thing that we do not want to go down that route. I do think we're very lucky here in Australia because we have the independent electoral commission. We have preferential voting, all those and compulsory voting. That means that we have a stronger democracy, but we need to keep working on it because democracy is fragile. Then, of course, there's a whole lot of unfinished business when it comes to the environment. Huge problems. I've got a lot that I want to get done on health, particularly focusing more on prevention so that we are preventing, we've got a huge mental health epidemic. We've got an overweight and obesity epidemic, which is now the major cause of chronic disease in our country. And we're spending very, very little or very little attention is focused on prevention. And that needs to change.
So the Centre for Public Integrity is so committed to trying to help restore trust in our political processes. No one wants to see them crumble and fade away. The last question really is, can you see any changes or improvements that could be brought in the next parliament that would help in that regard?
I think there's so much that we need to do. And I have to just say an enormous thank you to the Centre for Public Integrity for working with me on those ending Jobs for Mates legislation. We need to keep pushing on all these different things. And I think if we can start ticking these off, every single one of them makes our democracy stronger. As I said, greater transparency on lobbying, greater protections for our whistleblowers, ending pork barreling, truth in political advertising. These are really fundamental things. And if we have a stronger democracy, then better decisions flow from it. They can't be corrupted. So that's what, we all need to continue working for. We do need to get big money out of our political system. There does need to be far greater transparency around donations, all those types of things. So we've got a long way to go, but I feel like we're on the cusp of a lot of these things. The more that we talk about it, we're in there pushing hard for these things. We're not quite there, but sometimes I think we're closer than we realise. Even with that Jobs for Mates that I spoke about, I had so many different knockbacks, but when the opportunity came for the re-establishment of the Administrative Review Tribunal and we were ready to negotiate these independent selection panels. It was like, wow, that's incredible. How do we get that done? And I know that the Centre for Public Integrity has been working on these issues for so long and having that expertise and that evidence around what would be best practice has been incredibly helpful.
Well, to be honest, they're no-brainers, but politicians don't always see that. My final question to you is, Mrs. Worthington apparently famously advised her daughter against going on the stage, but what's your advice to younger people who are engaging with politics, perhaps for the first time, all these Gen Zers? You don't want to lose them, do we? They're the future.
No, I am trying my absolute hardest, as I think we all are, to try and bring everyone back into their democracy, and particularly young people. I mean, we spoke briefly about the mental health epidemic. And I think if people feel shut out and helpless and disempowered, that sort of feeds into that sense of mental distress in a way. So trying to bring people back in so they understand that I'm approachable, the other community independents are approachable, you can be heard. It is important that we listen to them. We're creating their future. They do have it tough at the moment. There is growing intergenerational inequality for many different reasons. There is converging crises. We've got climate, environment, housing crisis, mental health epidemic, got growing intergenerational inequality. All of these things have been coming for decades. And yet our political system has been unable to deal with them effectively. We know the problems. We know they're bad problems. We know the causes, and often we know the solutions as well, but still, they're sort of relentlessly getting worse. And so one of the things I did, my very last bill that I introduced a couple of weeks ago was the Wellbeing of Future Generations bill. So that is how we move away from this short-term thinking to try and embed long-term vision into the way we make decisions, both politically and for public bodies. And that's by using the principle that any decision that is made to meet the needs of the current generation can only be done if it doesn't compromise or undermine the ability of future generations to meet their needs and well-being. So you're embedding a long-term lens into your decision-making, but it's also ways of working, making sure that the decisions are not made in silos, but you have to also consider how the decisions that is made in one area may impact another sector or area's ability to meet their needs. So if you're thinking there's traffic congestion, let's build another freeway. Actually, how does that impact the economy, the budget? How does that impact the public health of the community? How does that impact the environment, the climate, the culture, all those different things? And sometimes it ends up with different decision making. And it may actually mean that you embed people with different experiences and expertise and skills into areas where they wouldn't normally be. So you might have a public health physician in the transport sector, that type of thing. So you really mix it up. So you're having conversations and different perspectives.
Sophie, it's been lovely talking to you today. Thank you for joining me on the Centre for Public Integrity's podcast. And good luck with everything you're doing.
Thank you, Michael, and thank you so much to the Centre for Public Integrity as well. We really appreciate the work you do there.